a little Mexican history for Cinco de Mayo. Chris Check is next. Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and it's Cinco de Mayo, which is a very special day here in Southern California, and especially just to the south of us in Mexico, because Cinco de Mayo is the celebration of the victory of the Battle of Puebla in 1862, in which Mexico kind of definitively freed itself from European influence. But we're going to talk about Mexico for Cinco de Mayo, but we're not going to really talk about Cinco de Mayo. We're going to talk about later history. What happened to the Catholic Church in the 20th century in Mexico? Here's Chris Check to talk about that with us. Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers. Bienvenidos.
Sí.
Oh, very good. Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about...
Très bien.
Cinco de Mayo gives us the opportunity to talk about Mexico.
It does.
Cinco de Mayo, however, is not what we're going to discuss. That's the Battle of Puebla.
It is.
1862, and a victory over the French.
Right.
Which... Yeah.
We'll talk about that next year.
Okay, we'll do that next year. But since we're out of the... One thing that...
It's kind of the last gasp. It's not actually Mexican independence. Some people confuse it with Mexican independence. It's not.
Right.
But it is sort of the last gasp of effort for European rule.
In Mexico. Yeah,
in Mexico. Right.
Okay, so here... today we'll talk about...
Assisted by Abraham Lincoln.
Really? Abraham Lincoln was...
I think we're just...
1862, he was on the side of the French?
No.
Oh, on the Mexicans?
No. It was not in the interest of Americans to have a European power
south of the
Rio Grande.
I see. Yeah. Okay, so... But
so another reason to like Abraham Lincoln or not.
Yes. And the thing is, Abraham Lincoln gives you lots of reasons to like him and lots of reasons not.
Another episode of Focus.
Yeah. Okay. Here's my question for you, though. We'll talk a little bit about the Cristeros.
Sí.
Just give us a general context of the Cristeros movement. What is that? When is it and what is it in Mexico?
The La Cristiada, as it's called, or the Cristero War, took place starting, around 1926, wraps up around 1929. Depends what you mean by wraps up, because, of course, the Cristero soldiers were hunted down and persecuted into the 50s, in fact.
Yeah.
They were Catholic soldiers, mostly landowning peasants, sharecroppers, rancheros. So landowners in the main who in western central Mexico, Jalisco, Guanajuato, the area that they call Aguascalientes, rose up against the anti-Catholic government of Mexico. Everyone, I gather, knows Miguel Pro. He's probably the most famous figure from this period. Blessed Miguel Pro, he himself not formally or technically a Cristero, we can talk about that, but he is among the martyrs in Mexico, Catholic martyrs in Mexico, victims of the anti-Catholic, Masonic, Marxist, atheist government of Mexico that attempts truly to suppress the Catholic Church.
But Miguel Pro's story is fascinating because of the photographs taken of his execution, which were intended to intimidate Catholic Mexicans and had exactly the opposite effect.
They did. By the time Pro is executed, the war is well underway, and the president at the time, president of Mexico at the time, a man named Plutarco Elias Calles printed the photographs of the martyrdom of Miguel Pro, ordered them printed in all of the Mexican newspapers, hoping that it would discourage the Cristero soldiers and their extensive support network. But it had the opposite effect. And soon he was telling the newspapers, stop printing them. I feel kind of like we're getting ahead. Mexico, since the middle of the 19th century, goes through a series of revolutions, political revolutions. The initial one in the middle of the early part of the 19th century, actually led by a sort of a renegade Jesuit priest, we'll call him, named Hidalgo, right? who becomes famous. His name is lent to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. But then there are a series of revolutions, a long period of dictatorship. But the revolution that fires this particular war actually takes place in 1917 with the rewriting, re-execution of the Mexican Constitution. And it is filled with anti-clerical codes designed, if not to drive the church from Mexican life altogether, at least considerably marginalize her influence. So, for example, priests after 1917 lose legal identity. If you're Father Kellett and I steal your car,
I can't.
You
do
have no recourse in the Mexican courts. So that's just a kind of what does that mean by legal identity? Well, Mexico, like the United States, I'm sure most of our listeners know, is it's a federal republic, at least in formation, if not in practice. And so enforcement of the 1917 Constitution varies from state to state.
Right.
And in the mid-20s, Plutarco Elias Calles adds teeth to the anti-clerical nature of the Constitution by use of the penal code, the code that says what the punishment will be for such and such crime, and calls for uniform enforcement of the 1917 Constitution throughout all of the states. So now government officials, if they fail to enforce the anti-clerical substance of the anti-Catholic, anti-clerical substance of the Constitution, then they face penalties. And that's really kind of when the rebellion, the Cristero rebellion, starts to take place.
Pick up steam. Just to pause for a quick second, because we had during the outbreak at the beginning of this century of the new atheism, there was this claim made that if only atheists could be in charge of governments, governments would be reasonable. And that it may be possible that there would be a reasonable atheist government, but it denies the evidence. When you think of 1917, most people would think of the Russian Revolution, openly atheist revolution. The Mexican Constitution of 1917, openly atheist. And they are remorselessly murderous.
And by the way, I would add to that list, because it's concurrent, what's coming in Spain.
Yeah.
So the Spanish, what's now known as the Spanish Civil War, which has roots well before the 1930s, but nonetheless, Pius XI, who's caught in the middle of this, referred to it as, I think, something like the Infernal Triangle or the Diabolical Triangle. But yeah, atheism is the central reality of these governments. So historically, that argument hasn't borne out.
It hasn't, and so we've got to be careful not to allow that kind of meme type thinking to go on without being at least a little checked by reality. But this kind of violent and oppressive atheism that assumes power, takes power in Mexico, is Marxist.
It is, and it's also Masonic.
Yeah. Okay. So,
and by the way, we should say funded from Russia.
Okay.
All the more so, by the way, in Spain in the 30s with the Comintern.
Sure.
But yes, supported, and as we'll find out if we dive deep in this, the Coolidge administration as well.
Well, this is what I want to ask you about, however, though, because I think the Marxist critique of the Cristeros, I'd like to dispense with that if I could, is this. The Catholic Church holds this kind of magical power over these ignorant peasants, because it's got all of its charms and all of its, you know, teachings about Jesus and hell and the Virgin Mary and all that. And these dumb peasants don't know that they're fighting against their own liberation. And so they fight to defend the church. This I think is a Marxist critique of Cristeros.
It is. And it's interesting that you bring this up, Si, because the very best scholarly history on the Cristero War actually is written by a Frenchman, a man named Jean Meyer. And he was a professor at the Sorbonne in the middle of the 70s, and he was a Marxist. And what he wanted to do was tell the story of the Cristero War from the Marxist perspective, which of course is what? Class struggle.
Right.
So he wanted to describe it as a class struggle. So now in the 70s, there are veterans of this war and people who felt its effects alive, many of them. And he travels to Mexico and interviews hundreds and hundreds of such people. And what he concludes, in fact, is that no, this was a war in which the government of Mexico tried to suppress the Catholic Church. And these people, far from it being a class struggle, like we're rising up for our rights of the worker, far from that, we're rising up in defense of Christ the King. We're rising up in defense of Our Lady of Guadalupe, right? For the as they say in the prayers at the foot of the altar, the Leonine prayers in the 1962 rite, the freedom and exaltation of Holy Mother Church. And something to bear in mind, Cy, is that this war is coinciding with, it's coming out inspired by what encyclical has just recently come out under Pius XI, his encyclical declaring the feast of Christ the King, saying that all political authority, all political authority, comes from Christ the King. We celebrate that feast at the end of the liturgical calendar now, but it used to be in October. And the shift in the calendar now is gives a sort of an eschatological quality to it, the final judgment and everything. But when Pius wrote that encyclical, he was very clearly making a point to the rulers of Russia, Spain, Mexico, your political authority derives from Jesus Christ. So in any case, to wrap up the Jean Meyer story, he comes to Mexico and he discovers through personal interviews, which is, you know, that's the primary source document par excellence, what the story truly was. Interesting fact, Meyer is brought back to the Catholic Church,
oh,
back
how
to
interesting.
His Catholic faith as a consequence. I think he's gone to his reward. I don't know. I think I remember reading that recently. But his work is available in French and in Spanish, and there's a translation in English that's not too bad either.
One of the things I think we've been trying to stress here at Catholic Answers, because we try to just teach what the Church teaches, not our own teachings, is that in recent years, it has become more and more necessary for us to say war is a last resort, that the habit of war is becoming ingrained in modern society in a way that we Catholics should be trying to break that habit. So was war really a last resort for these Cristeros?
You know, this is a complex political story.
Okay.
And we have the benefit of hindsight here. So let's do a little of the narrative and see if we can't answer this question.
Okay. Very good.
The enforcement of the Calles laws, as these additions to the penal code came to be called, meant, for example, okay, so priests have no legal identity, no more religious instruction in schools, priests can't wear their clerical attire in public. The activity of the foreign clergy, that is non-Mexican clergy, are deported mm-hmm. out of the country. If you were a priest, you had to register with your state government. If you didn't, you were basically an outlaw on the run. So you had two choices. In the south of Mexico, in Tabasco, the governor, his last name is Canabal, Tomas Canabal, who had his business card called him the personal enemy of God. He restricted the number of priests in his state to something like six.
Yeah.
And he forced them all, by the way, to get married. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is just an example of the kind of, and priests who didn't cooperate were hunted down, they were fined, in some cases they were tortured and they were executed. So so the bishops of Mexico have a difficult thing, and I guess there's probably 22, 25 of them, I don't know exactly how many, but in the 20s. There's three of them who are real firebrands.
Yeah,
and they're sending notices to the government that their region is seceding from the country of Mexico. There's one who's funding the Cristero army and considers taking the field with them. Some of the bishops flee the country. The head of the Mexican Episcopal Committee is a man named Pascual Diaz, and he consults with Rome. I think he's a full Guanajuato Indian, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that's a first in the history of Mexico, by the way. And he consults with the Holy See, and he says, look, the church can't operate under these conditions. We're going to, we, that is the church, we are going to stop liturgy. We're gonna close the churches. So the Catholic Church are the ones first to close the church. Now, why do they do this? Well, the best explanation for it is they're hoping to bring popular pressure
right on the government.
On the government. Yes. They're hoping to bring popular pressure. Right. So all these grandmothers who can no longer tell their beads in front of the Virgin of Guadalupe are going to tell their sons in government, it's time to back off.
It's something similar to the medieval practice of putting a country under
interdict.
Interdict.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's very similar, actually. Okay. I think that's a good insight, Cy. The government they don't respond to the pressure. And so then you get these what we would today sort of call think tanks or activists. Like the Union Popular, for example, and there's I forget in this in Spanish, but anyway, something like the Center for the Defense of Religious Liberty. Anacleto Gonzalez Flores, he is a blessed now, or he may actually be a saint. He was tortured and executed. Founded this, and they start to organize, and the organization starts to take the form of street protests and boycotts. Well, now the government is irritated. And actually, some of Mexicans wealthy are irritated because many of whom are Catholics, because the boycott is, you know, it's hurting their bottom line. So then the police are sent in with the fire hoses and the riot crews and the rubber bullets. And so it kind of devolves into violence. And there's not a point where the Holy See or the American Episcopal Committee says, we're going to form an armed rebellion. This is the decision of laymen. This is the decision of laymen. And I think they certainly did see it as a last resort. And by the way, you and I have talked recently about this with respect to more current events, but there is this question of reasonable expectation of success, or whatever the word is in the catechism there. Well, when you look at the progress that the Cristero army makes, you can see that
there were serious prospects.
Yeah, there were serious prospects of success.
Right.
Now, a lot of it depended on where America would land on the question.
Right, as so often is the case in Mexico. Yeah,
right.
Poor Mexico, yeah.
But I think there was reason to hope.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, right. I'm talking too much.
No, but I remember in reading an article that you wrote about this a while ago that Calles himself said they're annihilating us.
They are annihilating us. And then later on when he's in, after he has retired and he's in either Texas or I think San Diego, in fact, or something, he's in the United States. And he said, trying to suppress the Catholic Church was the most foolish thing I ever did.
Yeah.
It's the most foolish thing I ever did. But he did. The correspondence from from Calles to his successor, the president who follows him, a man named Portes Gil, I think, he writes him, they're annihilating us. And the American attaché writes back to the State Department, American State Department's marveling at the discipline and the fervor of the Cristero Army and the utter lack of discipline and the high desertion rates of the Mexican federal troops. So— yeah.
That was Ann Morrow's father.
Ann Morrow's father is the, yes.
Oh, that's a different guy.
No. Oh. Yeah. Dwight Morrow. He's the man who eventually brokers the peace.
Yeah.
Yeah. But all part of the U.S. State Department.
So is the peace a neat thing in that, okay, the Cristeros have certain demands. I mean, they're going to need priests. They're going to need to be able to share the faith. These things that have been shut down, they're going to need to get back. Was it a clear-cut victory in that sense?
No, by no means it was. But let me answer one more question with respect to prospects of success.
Okay.
The Cristeros, and I love this story, and it's something all the ladies should be attentive to. Especially the Cristeros have an extensive logistic network in the form of what they call the Joan of Arc brigades or the Joan of Arcs. Something like 25,000 single women between the age of 15 to 25 design special vests to smuggle ammunition. I mean, this is just an amazing tale. To smuggle ammunition out of federal factories, the ammunition is going, you know, from one fruit cart to the next in the market. These women are going out into the battlefield, picking up unexploded ordnance to repurpose it for the Cristero army. This is dangerous work. Yeah. And they're hiding messages in the soles of their shoes. And 25,000 single girls between the age of 15 to 25 years old, there's no evidence that any one of them broke the oath.
No, so, the oath of secrecy.
Yes.
That way they won't talk. They won't.
Yeah. But anyway, I didn't mean to derail. So they come to the table. And the man that brings them to the table is Dwight Morrow and Lindbergh's father. I've always thought this is kind of a political, it's a smile or an irony. We all know Charles Lindbergh, who marries Anne. Charles Lindbergh is a famous isolationist. Now, I don't mean isolationist as a slur here, but he was an America firster for sure.
Boy, was he, yeah.
Yes, he was.
Right.
And tried to keep us out of the Second World War. And but his father-in-law was one of the biggest meddlers in the history of, brokering J.P. Loan Morgan, when he was with J.P. Morgan, brokering loans for the British during the First World War and everything. So this guy was a massive meddler. So I just kind of always wondered, you know,
what was Thanksgiving like in that family?
Exactly. Exactly. What were the dinner table conversations like?
Yeah.
But anyway, so Morrow, whatever his international politics, we don't have to admire them, or maybe some people do. I do not. But nonetheless, he was a skilled diplomat, and he does bring the sides together. And the bishops, I think we can say, act in good faith, which is more than we can say of the U.S. State Department. Or, by the way, the United States government provided air support for the Mexican federal army against the Catholic army.
Yes.
But the American State Department, Coolidge administration, whatever you want to call it, the Mexican government, they did not act in good faith. The Catholic Church does, and they say, well, you're gonna have to return the church property. And there's even a line there in the arreglos, the agreements, insofar as can reasonably expect it or something like that.
Yeah, that's what...
Well, it doesn't go as expected.
No.
And if you read Pius XI, his encyclical Acerba Animi, he makes it very clear. I asked the Cristero soldiers to lay down their arms. This they did. And yet the government of Mexico is not cooperating.
Right.
And in some cases into the 30s, the government itself shuts down the practice of the faith. It's in the 30s, by the way, that you as a great English major, Cy, will know Graham Greene's magnificent work of genius, Power and the Glory.
Yeah.
But also, he wrote a nonfiction account, which I recommend very highly to anybody, called Lawless Roads. He went to Mexico, and so did Evelyn Waugh, wrote Robbery Under Law, which are two good accounts of Mexico right after the Cristero War.
Now, this would be around 1934 is actually the worst of it.
Yeah,
you wrote
35,
that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Mid-30s, though Cristero veterans, men who actually fought and died in the Cristero War, or fought rather, and retired, are hunted down into the 50s and executed.
Right.
And there's mass executions following the arreglos in Jalisco. When I give this talk, and I'm asked to come to parishes and give it, I'm happy to. I have about 100 images that go with it. Some of them are quite stirring. You see just, it almost looks like, you know, crucifixions along the Appian Way or something. Uh-huh. You see these men hanging from the telegraph poles in Mexico, men who just gave their souls for Christ, hearts and souls for Christ the King, like the little boy martyr there, Jose Sanchez del Rio.
Yeah, and as you said, this went on into the 50s.
Yeah.
So they're still killing men.
And I would say fairly, you know, what do you want to call it? Aggressive persecution of the church, if not hot persecution, continues well into the 80s.
Oh,
right?
Certainly.
When do, so when you get in the 80s, a change of political power there, and you'll help me with the names of the
Pan and the Pri and the
exactly. Or I'm trying to think what the PRI loses to Vicente Fox, right? What year is that?
That had to be in the 90s.
2000. Yeah.
Oh, was it?
But anyway, it's not until 80s or 90s that clergy are permitted to wear their clerics in public, and a lot of them just still don't because the social pressure is there. And right. An excellent example of this, of course, is Miss Mexico in 2007.
Yeah, I know, 2007.
Wears a dress honoring the Cristeros, and she is just ridiculed in the Mexican press, opening old wounds. And it's, you can find it. It's quite a dress. She's with the bandoliers and the scapulars and...
Well, even though Marxism as a publicly professed goal is rare nowadays, a general modernizing impulse still deeply and profoundly opposes the Catholic Church and sees the Catholic Church essentially as the villain in these stories.
Is it, you know, to that exact point, Si, when I first started looking at the Cristero War 15 years ago, maybe it was probably more than that even, I had an extensive phone interview with a woman who had lived in Mexico and her parents especially during this time. But she described for me growing up in Mexico in the 70s, in this Aguascalientes region where a lot of this fighting took place. And she said, in our school, you could teach values.
Yeah, yes, right.
Values. So, yeah. I mean, when I hear people talk about values, I get very nervous.
Yeah, it almost always means not teaching Christ.
Yes.
It means anything except mention the name of Jesus Christ.
Right, yeah. Right.
Especially in Catholic colleges here in the United States.
Yes,
we're
precisely.
Deeply committed to the values of the Christian faith. That means we're not going to mention Christ.
Yes, or the sacraments or revealed truth.
But when you consider the business we're in, radio, for example, you have fine Mexican Catholic radio programs being produced in Mexico that still to this day cannot be broadcast in Mexico.
Yes.
They go out over EWTN to Argentina or, you know, wherever else, but they can't be broadcast in Mexico because partisan religion is not permitted in Mexico,
yes.
Which means you can do basic prayer, that kind of thing, but you can't advocate for Christian positions on the air.
This is just this is one of the effects of the war, and of course, I think events that precede it, of course. But Catholic Answers, you know, just very recently, we has designed a. We've always produced things here and there, like Pillar of Fire and Spanish and things like this. But we'll be coming out with a Spanish translation of Trent's book. Why we're Catholic.
I was so happy to hear
that. And preparing it for free distribution insofar as we can be supported by that because there is a catechesis problem in Mexico among Mexican Catholics who may be cultural Catholics. And so you have Jehovah's Witnesses and you have Mormons showing up on the doorstep, I kid you not, Si, holding an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe to start the conversation.
Right.
And the Mexicans are uncatechized and unprepared. And it is to the fore in my prayers that this apostolate can take some of the good that we've been doing here and start to bring it to our Latino brothers and sisters.
Well, I do think
are culturally Catholic. I mean,
right.
There's nothing that so what can I say informs the Mexican understanding of herself as the Catholic faith.
No, I'll say this to you: the fabric of Mexican culture is a tilma.
Yes, it is. Well, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And here in San Diego, in California, we certainly benefited from much of this because we got so many wonderful religious orders, religious men and women.
Sure. Let's be very clear what you mean by that, Si. Yeah. The first wave of Mexican immigration to Texas and to California is because of Plutarco Caius's scorched earth policy. So he's burning fields.
Yeah.
There's a shortage of grain. He's forcing the rural population to move into the urban population. And he's also shutting down monasteries, seminaries,
right.
abbeys, convents. So for example, Alhambra, the Carmelites, right. Our friend's sister Regina Gorman was just down here.
Right.
Their origins are in the Cristero War. The Carmel in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yeah.
Their origins are in the Cristero War. So you're absolutely right.
Well, we have parishes here in San Diego whose front doors face Mexico.
Right.
Because they were put there so that Mexicans could walk across the border and come to Mass.
Yes.
We also have an abortion clinic down in Chula Vista, which has a big picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe
yeah.
on the front of it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
there is, I just want to point to that because of the, you're right, there's this manipulation because... where there's great piety in Mexico, there has not been great catechesis.
No.
And maybe this is something that, you know, having received so many gifts from Mexico here in the United States, maybe American Catholics can consider making those catechetical materials for Mexicans in the United States that might find their way to Mexico
yes,
as well and be
yeah,
helpful.
Yeah, I think, of course, the Latino and the Mexican population in the United States is exactly where we need to begin. You know, Si, you hear me say this from time to time, the Guadalupe apparition, I know people have their different ones that draw their attention, draw their heart. This is the one that particularly enchants me, if I'm allowed to say that. I think that really is the word.
Right.
And the reason, there are many reasons for it. I love the Cortez story because he, you know, he's not an easy guy for sure, but he does plow the field that our Lady reaps.
Yeah.
And this is the apparition where she appears pregnant. It's the one.
Yeah,
with that Encina band, I'm forgetting how they say it, but that shows that she's pregnant, and so I just think the story isn't over. I just think the Guadalupe story isn't over, and this is why I don't know. I think about these things in my own life because my brother is the head of the Guadalupe Shrine there up in La Crosse, and Cardinal Burke was not going to build that shrine to Our Lady of Guadalupe. It was going to be to Our Lady of Fatima. But then he read John Paul's encyclical, Ecclesia in America, and he said—
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, and he said, no, this needs to be to Our Lady of Guadalupe. And now the shrine in La Crosse has been elevated by the Holy See so that when you go to La Crosse, it is the equivalent graces that you would get if you went to see the Tilma in Mexico City. So and we're coming up on the 500th anniversary. It's of the apparition. It's going to be here in 31, right? That'll be the 500th. So something, you know,
there's more to the story. I always like it when you say
it's coming. That's what, something yeah. is more to the story here. And I pray that Catholic Answers can be part of this tale. And I also pray that the blood of these Mexican martyrs in the Cristero War, Christopher Magallanes, the great priest who kept the secret of the confessional, you know, and this boy, Jose Sanchez del Rio, and 14-year-old boy enduring this horrible torture and just shouting, Viva Cristo Rey, the whole way, and just telling his torturers, I will be meeting God and I will be asking him directly to bring confusion to you. And just the grits and the fire. So I just think this blood, I know this blood was not spilled in vain. Tertullian said long ago, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the faith, and how God is going to perfect the sacrifices of the Mexican martyrs, we're going to find out. And I think we're going to find out here as this decade unfolds.
Christopher Check, president of Catholic Answers. Muchas gracias.
Ah, très bien.
So which side were you on at the Battle of Puebla?
Yeah,
thanks, Chris.
Topo Chico.
Topo Chico.
God bless you, Si.
You too. Thank you, Chris.
All right.
Well, happy Cinco de Mayo to you. Thank you very much for joining us for this bonus episode of Catholic Answers Focus. Maybe you got an idea for a future bonus episode. Maybe you want to comment on this one. You can always send us an email. focus@catholic.com is our email address, focus@catholic.com. We need your financial support to keep doing what we're doing. And if you're willing to support us financially, you can do that by going to givecatholic.com. Leave a little note that says this is for Catholic Answers Focus. givecatholic.com. If you're watching on YouTube, thanks. We are definitely growing on YouTube. Help us to grow by hitting that little bell, and then you'll be notified when new episodes are available. Encourage others to subscribe as well, if you don't mind. One thing that encourages people to subscribe to the podcast, if you listen on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, one of those services, if you just give us that 5-star review, maybe a few nice words, that really does help to grow the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe there so you'll be notified when new episodes are available. I got to go have a margarita. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.